once a soldier starts exhibiting or reaching out for help or saying, hey, listen, I'm having a problem. I'm really struggling right now. That day, they need a mental health day. They need a break. They still got to be at formation to 0600 or else.
Hey everyone, Nathan Long here, president of Saybrook University, right here in Pasadena, California. Welcome to another episode of Saybrook Insights. My guest today is the passionate, fiery Saybrook alumna, Katrina Sesney. Wow, what an interview. She's working on finishing her dissertation research at Saybrook University, and we're going to delve into that along with her work on the juvenile justice system during her master's project. We're going to hear about these and more during the interview. Katrina is truly, 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 truly an inspiring scholar practitioner. So let's get to it with Ms. Katrina Sesney. Katrina Sesney, oh my goodness, it is so good to have you here today on Saybrook Insights. I caught wind of the research you're doing through our Dean of Students, our actual Assistant Vice President, Dr. Shanice McGill. She was so excited about the work you're doing. And she's like, Nathan, I think this is going to be awesome. And I'm like, as she talked to me about it, I'm like, this is amazing. So really want to dig into that and much more. But before we begin, could you just talk a little bit about how you found your way to Saybrook University?
When I landed at Saybrook, I was going through such a life transition. At that point, I'd been an active duty military spouse for a couple years. I had finished my bachelor's in psychology, criminal justice studies for about a year and a half. I'd been out of school trying to debate whether I was going to grad school or not. And when I looked at grad school programs for psychology and stuff, it just didn't ever excite me. I don't know what it was, but being an active duty military spouse for a couple years and moving away from home, rural Tennessee, you know, South Texas, those are my areas that I understand and I know. And went right off to Alaska, started seeing the world. And something hit me going out and running around and going on these adventures that how different each and every one of us live all throughout the territories, all throughout the United States of America. And yet the struggles and the suffering is all the same. That's what I was seeing. That's what I was experiencing out there. So when I started looking at graduate programs, I was looking to go start my master's. I stumbled upon Saybrook. And I found a social systems transformation course. I found human science. I found like-minded people that had a passion, had a fire to make change and create justice and make things just as hunky-dory for everyone. And it was a blessing. And so the life that I had lived and the things I had gone through, that was the education. Humanistic psychology, that was the education that I was lacking. That's what I needed. So, Saybrook, I found.
That's amazing. I think I need to button that up and take that with me wherever I go. That's very inspiring. Seriously, a really, really terrific way of putting that. You said you were an active military spouse, and I certainly don't want to pry into too many personal details, but would you be willing to talk a little bit about that journey for you? Because clearly that took you around the country. Yeah.
My journey specifically as an active duty military, we've all wore these different hats all throughout our lives and different ages. But from age 28 to currently, I'm going through a divorce, being married as an active duty military spouse for almost 13 years, just turned 41. But the life you commit to being the spouse of an active duty service member in the United States military, in this military industrial complex, with a huge heart, that commitment you make is in ways a moral injury to the spouse themselves, not just the soldiers and what they go through, but the spouses. And because we come to the table with our own thoughts and hearts and values and morals, and we get tossed in. Because when you go into the military, you're tossed in, no matter where you're from. Doesn't matter where you're from. You're tossed in, you are molded, and so is your family and your spouses and your children. We understand we have military kid month. You know, we recognize I have four of them. I have four military kids. And it's a whole entire lifestyle being in the military. alone, standalone from civilian lifestyle. Military lifestyle is its own complex system going on. It's very secluded. And we move every 2 years. We move from spot to spot. So we lived in Alaska. We had 4 years just being us. 1 year he spent in Afghanistan. He was deployed. He's a combat engineer. Very, very dangerous job. Lost a whole lot of brothers. He lost many friends. As a spouse hanging back in Alaska at that time, I was helping run a national nonprofit, Armed Services YMCA. I was an administrative assistant. I was a program manager. I was a temporary director. I ran over 33 programs for all the military families, especially the children. So while they were gone, my job, my literal job, was to Fairbanks, Alaska, very secluded, very beautiful, whose military at Fort Wainwright provides about 60 to 65% of the economic, all the income for the Fairbanks area. So not only was I running Armed Services YMCA and running these programs with my help of my people down in Anchorage, I was sitting on the military affairs board in town in Fairbanks. So I was socializing, interacting, and listening to policy and change, and sitting at the Chamber of Commerce luncheons and listening to actual locals born and raised and transplanted, especially transplanted to the Fairbanks area. And all these decisions that affect the military and what the military is going through affects this town. And I see that, and I'm living it, and I'm playing on a local softball league and hanging out with everybody and going to all the fundraisers. Part of my job was fundraising. So that experience alone was very traumatizing in a way, but it was very heart-feeling. My servant's heart was satisfied because the whole entire time that I lived in Alaska, I was serving the local community and serving the military families while I was dealing with a spouse that was deployed with bombs and guns and war and all the reality of war, and being his support system back home and his family support system. And we didn't have children at the time. Bless it, we did not have children. And so I was standing in and being the spouse for these other military spouses that had children. So these mothers, some were pregnant, some had 2-3 small children. So I would step in and drive them to 2-3 feet of snow on the ground. I would drive them to the grocery store, make sure these babies had groceries, and the things we did for each other. It was a beautiful experience. But again, it was alone. As a military spouse, you're always alone. They're gone all the time. But yeah, we traveled, drove through Canada, got to see beautiful Canada. Coming back, we lived in Florida. I had a baby born in Florida. We lived in Texas. I had a baby born in Texas. We lived in upstate New York. I had a baby born there. And then the fourth one was born in Southern California. So I had a little chain all across the United States. I've lived in every corner because of the military, being transplanted and displaced. And I've had a child born in all these different territories across the U.S. And it's been exciting, but it's been very lonely, you know. And then, of course, you have the soldier. He has his own whole experience of being in the military for 13 years, completely different than mine.
How so?
Well, he's a soldier. He has the commitment to the mission. He has the vow. We take our vows on this side. People take their vows on that side. I will always find compassion and understanding for any human being. Do I agree with the military industrial complex? Absolutely not. Do I agree with the history? Absolutely not. But I support that soldier. I supported him the entire marriage. I still support him as the father to my 4 children. I will always support him, especially his mental health and his rights as a soldier. When they come home, we are obligated as a society to take care of these people, you know, whether they volunteered or were voluntold, as we call it. Some even without the draft, some of us, because of the expectations from our society, especially as men and poor men that need to provide for their families. There's a lot of expectations to serve your country in the military. And it does. It does bring benefits, but it brings mandatory mental health. issues they come up. It's kind of comes with it when you sign that contract. It's guaranteed that things are going to change. Your experiences are going to change. You're going to be exposed to the most gruesome violence. And that's just no other way to put it. You're exposed on purpose
to violence. Yeah.
So that you may create and prevent violence, whatever our excuse, whatever our narrative is for the moment. But yeah, so his experience has been drastically different than mine, but I have to carry as a spouse and the four children, you got to carry the load to handle him and everything that he's gone through and the way he's changed, to handling myself and everything I've gone through and the ways I've changed so many different ways, especially becoming a mother. Goodness, a graduate student. Goodness, like there's a lot of identity crises going on in there. So a lot of change.
All at the same time, right?
You just roll with it. You just learn to roll with it.
You brought up and I know we could probably spend 2 or 3 hours talking about this, but you brought up a term that I think is really interesting, especially how you applied it to military spouses. And you indicated along the lines of a moral injury done to or committed against, however you want to frame that. I don't want to put words in your mouth related to military spouses. Can you talk a little bit more about what moral injury is and how that's received, especially as a military spouse?
I would begin with experience. Each and every single human being is going to have their own experience and what they're being exposed to or subjected to in life. And that's how I see the world. So when I chose to become a military spouse, I had an idea of what was coming. I had an idea of what the 60s and 70s in the U.S. looked like. I had an idea of what the 20s and 40s and 1920s and 40s in the U.S. looked like. I had an idea of what I thought a military spouse was and what their job was, what their role was, what the expectations upon them were. And then you sign up to be a military spouse. And I, along with my own personal trauma from childhood and life, I am committing myself to a soldier to be their support system in a system that does not support them. In a system that turns their back once they actually reach out for help. For example, it is well known in the military culture, less so now, but definitely throughout our history, that once a soldier starts exhibiting or reaching out for help or saying, hey, listen, I'm having a problem. I'm really struggling right now. Or sick call, they wake up in a mental state and they really just can't handle life that day. They need a mental health day. They need a break. They still got to be at formation to 0600 or else. You cannot call in sick. You cannot take a mental health day. You cannot take a break. You cannot sit and go to your sergeant and be like, hey, listen, I've really been struggling lately. I haven't been sleeping. I haven't been eating. I've been really irritable. I got a lot on my mind. Because if you do, once you get labeled and you get seen in the mental health, and you get seen at behavioral health, this label and this stigma comes along with it. And a lot of them that are career-oriented must hold back. So they have to find other outlets, of course. So you got to find other support systems. If you can't go to the mental health department and ask for help because it will stigmatize your career, it will halt your career. It will put a flag in your folder, in your jacket, you're flagged. So if you can't do that, you've got to go where we know to go. You go to your family. You go to your spouse, usually, right? You go to your family. You go to your parents. You go to your friends. You go to your drinking buddies, whatever your outlet is, to have a mental health day, to have a release, to have a, oh, this is what I got going on, and I need some help. Like, I'm really struggling. I don't know if I can keep showing up. I don't know if I can keep taking care of these people. I don't know. I feel like I'm going to snap. We've all been there, I think, as humans. So for soldiers themselves, for the longest time, once they're labeled as mental health issue, once they get medicated, especially too, now we reach out, antidepressants, anti-anxiety, once they get medicated, their duties decrease. Like, they're not considered reliable by any means anymore. A lot of them get chaptered out. A lot of them are, we call it med board. They get med boarded right out. As soon as they start seeing a psychiatrist, as soon as they start seeing a therapist and start talking, some of them get flagged. And so along those lines, that's your career that you had in mind. That's your stability. That's your home. That's how you support your family. So it's hard. So as spouses, moral injury. Not only do we go through our own experiences, we have to see what comes home to us every day. If it comes home sometimes. Sometimes it's gone for months. We have to see what's walking through the door. I walked on eggshells for years and years and years and years because I never know what's going to walk through the door. At one point, there was a drinking problem. And so not only do I have to see what mood is walking through the door, but I got to see, is that mood been masked before it walks through the door? Now I've got to deal with all this. I also have to keep updated with the news and what's going on. I know that 3,000 soldiers just got deployed before the U.S. knows 3,000 soldiers just got deployed. I already know what's going on. And so I'm waiting for the backlash. I'm waiting for the conversations. So I'm carrying this and I'm carrying this and I'm carrying so much and I'm carrying the weight of the world globally. For example, when we watch our soldiers go and commit atrocities, in my opinion, we have to watch this and we have to support that soldier that still comes home. Because that's our job and that's our commitment and that's what we signed up for when we took those vows. And so it comes with your own morals and your own values, your own stances and where you stand in the world. You still have to be open and accepting and be there for that person as much as you can, because they're just a human trying to wake up and survive just like you are. And it's hard. And so I personally, through my personal experience, was already a traumatized child, was already, you know, an adult trying to deal with CPTSD and anxiety, trying to deal with everything. And then I decided, I made the choice to marry a soldier. So it comes along with it. You know what you're getting yourself into. Kinda, but be prepared. So it's not as romanticized as a lot of people would have it.
Yeah, it resonates with a lot of stories I've heard from friends and colleagues who've been both military and military spouses. I think there's so much of what you say there's a commonality of experience, it seems like, amongst many. I appreciate you sharing that because it's intense, and I'm sure for your husband, your ex-husband soon to be, I know that has not been an easy journey for all of you. I mean, so thank you for sharing that very difficult but very enlightening experiences on your part, or those experiences. So you've had an interesting journey here at Saybrook too. You've done some really, well, I know from over the pandemic, you led some interesting and very unique dialogues around a variety of topics related to policing reform and the like. And you ended your master's degree on the topic of the juvenile justice system. And, you know, it's interesting, just a few months ago, I was having this conversation with a close family member about this very topic. And it's very convoluted and controversial. Maybe it doesn't need to be, but it is. And from your perspective, what did you find out in the course of doing this project? We'll get to your dissertation in a moment because I want to talk more about that. But this was of interest to me just by virtue of the fact that there's so much of this in the national zeitgeist now too. So both and. So tell us a little bit more about that work.
So my master's degree, my master's program, I wound up at Saybrook in a human science degree. And the people alone that I was exposed to, the literature I was exposed to, the ideas, and the fact that you had the opportunity to be a professional out in the world, to still go to school full time, to raise a family full time, to do whatever you wanted to do, and still learn, read, write. I thought it was phenomenal. So graduate school to me was a completely different experience than undergrad. It was an upper level of reading and writing constantly. For people like me that will read and write for the rest of their lives, that was heaven. So I ended up this human science program, and I showed up with one thing in mind, one goal: children's rights advocate. That was it. I was all for children's rights. That's it. We're going into this. This ain't been done right over all these years. I am sick and tired of watching this crap. As a child who grew up, I had so many ideas and I was so driven, and I just knew that it was all about children's rights. And so I started going through this degree program. I discovered transformative social change, and I learned how to actually listen to legislation. I learned how to read policies. I learned how to sit back and watch a congressional meeting and actually understand, oh my goodness, because you just affected the next two generations. In 2 minutes, 2 minutes top, you just made a decision that affected the next two generations. In 1 minute, less than 1 minute, you made a decision that defunded millions of dollars to children in less than a minute. So I started paying attention. And I started seeing the power of one person getting up and speaking. I was like, okay, now, where's your passion? So I see that you are up here in the Senate, in legislation, and you have children's rights on your agenda. And you are speaking for these children. But where is your passion? Where's your experience? Because I don't see you're mad enough. You are not mad enough for this money being defunded from the children and their education. You are not mad enough over the millions of children that we go through foster care every year. You're not mad enough. And so nothing's getting done, because it's kind of like, bipartisan stuff that gets passed. So I started watching. My entire life, I was exploring the juvenile justice system in more ways than one. I was a delinquent by all means as a child, because I defied authority. I said no to every person in charge. I wanted to see what boundaries you had. I had reasons beyond a shadow of a doubt of why I was a teenager acting out and mouthy and saying no to every authoritative person, because I saw all the power that people held. Adults held all the power. As a small child, that's all you see. Adults have all the power. They make all the rules. They tell you what to do. Well, what about if those adults are unhealthy and toxic and self-centered and addicts? And they have all the power still, and they make all the rules, and they tell you what to do, and they determine your entire daily life, these adults with all the power do. What makes this adult in this toxic, dysfunctional home any different than the adult that's the principal at the local school? Because I've seen them, and they're exactly the same. What makes that adult's power any different than the minister right down the road that everybody goes to that Baptist church, and if you ain't, they're going to talk about you? What makes his power any different than the principal or the father at home? They all hold the same power. And I saw that as a child, a very, very abused, dysfunctional child in the home that I grew up in, very rural Tennessee. I saw a lot. I heard a lot. But I saw the power that each one of these adults held. And then, of course, you know, you grow up through the juvenile system. I got threatened because I had the privilege in a small little rural white town. All I had to do was present myself very well and show my straight A's, and I could use my privilege to get out of trouble. Even though I was driving the car at age 16 that had the marijuana in the car, that was my marijuana. It wasn't those other kids' marijuana. It was mine. But I walked out of court that day. I didn't get in trouble. I was the one, when we got pulled out of a car, that was yelling and cussing at the cops as a 16-year-old little girl. But when we went to court that day, I didn't get in trouble. I walked out. So I learned at a very early age the privilege that my body and my skin and my face and my mouth can bring me when I choose so. When I can just flip that script and choose privilege, or when I can choose chaos. So as a child, I learned, okay, I have power too. So I see your power and I see mine. And I watched everyone go through the juvenile justice system. I watched myself go through it. I was in court here in Carroll County, Tennessee at age 16. I got charged with being unruly. But I got to walk out, though. I didn't have to be locked up like a lot of the kids in court that day. So my master's project, when I decided I had to do something, I decided, well, I'm going to look at this entire system. Because how is my system in small, white, rural, very Baptist, very Christian Tennessee any different than the system, the juvenile justice system, over in Kansas? How's it different than the one in Texas? How's it different than the one in New York State? I want to see in Los Angeles, because we always hear about these Chicago kids and these Los Angeles kids. Well, how are we different? So that's what I looked at. So for my master's project, juvenile justice system, I took a look at the U.S. policy across the nation of all these various juvenile justice systems that we have, because we have institutions, we have correctional systems. Of course, these children have been locked up with adults in the very beginning, and then we start separating them. They're still being locked up with adults. They're being tried as adults. Just breaks your heart when you see these kids in there. We know that a lot of these kids across the nation have been sold. The judges are being paid off. The district attorneys are being paid off. And we have this documented throughout our history. It's no different than it is today than it was 20 years ago when they got caught. It's no different. So we have children growing up in these homes. They are at the hands of the power. It's abuse of power. These children are growing up. They're not being taken care of. They're not being guided. They're being children that are subjected to abusive power. So how they react as a human being, I can't imagine. I've been there. I've reacted that way. I was full of rage. I was full of anger. I was just full of disgust for every human being around me. I was so disgusted with the teachers at school. I was disgusted with the guidance counselor. I was disgusted with the local police department. I was disgusted with the firefighters. There were so many people that you meet every day in your life, and you watch them see the wreckage being done to these children. And they choose not to step up. They choose not to say anything. It's a small town. So I was curious, are small towns any different than cities? That was pretty much my search when I did that master's project. And I found out it is no different, because in the U.S. culture, across the board, the U.S. juvenile justice system is built on and founded in the separation of the child from society. Now, we can call it rehabilitation, but you're further traumatizing this child. That's all you're doing. There's no excuses for it. They're not learning anything. We can call it rehabilitation, but we've seen the recidivism rates, of course, and we've seen the pipeline from the school to the juvenile justice system to the adult prison system. We've seen it. It's there. It's not. We've been yelling about it for a long time. So as you'd mentioned, a project.
The K to prison pipeline, right?
We see it. It's so blatant right there in front of us. And there's no argument about it. And it's a modern day slavery. It's all it is we've gone from one form of slavery to another, to another, to another. And we've been screaming this for a long time, so many people. And it's just inexcusable at this point when we have these voices out here now. I see what social media can do for legislation. We see what social media and TV nowadays can do to promote the youth to get more involved and use their voice. And so the final part of that was my hope and desire is that all these children, like I was, get lit on fire with their voices, and they get out there and they stand. We're seeing it. We're seeing it in Tennessee legislation. We're seeing it with these kids or standing up against anti-trans legislation. We're seeing it right now. We're seeing it today. These kids are getting out there and they're yelling and they're screaming and they're saying, no, we're not taking this no more. And that is a product of being oppressed as a child. They're done. They're not going to deal with this anymore. And so if they don't agree with it, they're up in hands and they're out here. And I'm loving it. That project was a huge piece of my heart, because it was a huge piece of who I was as a child, was exposed to, the privilege I saw blatantly right there in front of me, and seeing that I was just another one in an entire nation of children. If you aren't born into the right family in the United States of America, your opportunity for happiness is drastically just, because you have all those social detriments just stacked up against you.
It's the hidden caste concept, right?
We
say we're not a caste system, but there certainly is evidence to show that, to your point, right?
Definitely. I see it feeding the cattle to our workforce is what I see. And now with new legislation sweeping across the nation, we're lowering the working age of the children again. Just today, we are lowering the age. They're saying, as of right now, I believe in the state of Kansas, that the 14-year-olds can work night shifts in the factories. We cannot turn back time. We cannot go back. And here we are.
After, what was it, 108 years ago, something like that? I mean, when that legislation was passed to protect children. I mean, it's crazy. I really love your passion around this. We need to have you back to just talk about that alone. We've got so many ideas around a future, not just a podcast, but shedding light on, and not just shedding light on, but talking about next steps in action. I also want to get to your dissertation topic in the remaining minutes we have, because I think there's some connection points here as well to what you just did on your master's, especially around race, racial justice, anti-racism. Talk a bit about you're not done with your dissertation, but bo you're getting there, close. You're almost Dr. Sesney. Talk to us for a few minutes about the work you're doing in your dissertation. What inspired you to get into this work? What are your kind of preliminary findings so far? That kind of thing.
Well, I'm a doctoral candidate as of right now. I'm blessed with such a beautiful committee. They're just such beautiful people, great guides in my spirit world. Just the love I have for these people. As a graduate student, going through your master's degree, and it's not enough. I could have went right to work. I could have started teaching in that moment. I could have ran with it. I could have jumped into policy. I could have went back into the workforce, but it wasn't enough. I still had these questions lingering. And so I had a talk with my advisor, my department chair, and I said, I'm staying. And I'm going to stay specifically for, we were just now starting the Transformative Social Change Department. So I came to Saybrook in 2012, right before you'd attended. So I remember when you come in as president, and I've seen the changes, and we're so grateful. Like we the it's like our humanistic mission is more out there, and that's I love to see it everywhere. But I just knew it wasn't enough, and with the Transformative Social Change Program starting, that was it. That was my calling. That was my moment of action, because now I know these things and my heart's on fire and it's been on fire, but what do I do? What to do with all this energy inside of me? And I have these four children at this point. No, I had graduated. I walked the stage with my master's degree, 6 months pregnant with the second child. All four of my children were born at Saybrook. Everybody at Saybrook's held all my babies. And so when I started the PhD program a year later into the program, I was pregnant with a third child. And in the very beginning, I thought I was going to dive deeper and go from the juvenile justice system to the correction system. I was headed into abolition. I was headed into the bigger, broad picture of what I want this world to look like for all the children. What do the children need to thrive? What do we need for optimal development? What should society give? We're breeding them. We're forcing them to be born. Like these kids just wake up one day born. They're not asking to be born. So what do we need to create for them? That was my goal in life, was I was going to figure out how we get from this juvenile justice system that's just disgusting, and it's not doing anything for society. It's making it worse. It's re-traumatizing all these children that are born into a traumatized society. We're all full of this collective trauma, generational, just feeding off of each other. I need something more trauma-informed. That was my goal for my PhD. So I started down the rabbit hole, and going down the rabbit hole and going through globalism courses, going through social system transformation courses, going through ethics, and I stumbled upon it. Really was just more of a personal transition I was going through with my own family. I was going through some trauma with my own family that made me kind of wake up and just start screaming, I am sick and tired of this white supremacist shit. Excuse the language.
Yeah, that's fine.
But I woke up screaming and I was sick of it. And I was just so disgusted. Trump got elected. My mama called me drunk one night. My husband found out my husband was cheating on me. He was hiding a drinking problem. I was writing a paper for a globalism class on slavery globally, kind of like the historical essence of human slavery. I had a lot going on in this moment. And I woke up one day screaming that I am so sick of this white supremacist shit. I am done. I am sick of it. And I could just, it was like your eyes open and you can see what's right in front of you. And once you see it, you can never unsee it. That's just how it works for you. And What I saw is what I'm calling white altruism. This is where my PhD work is starting to take off into, is I call it white altruism. What I see in front of me is this strategic colonizing tactic, white settler colonialism. It's supported by your white elitist philanthropic, historically men, of course. It has established racist power globally. Because we know how we've all started these white settler colonizations. U.S. is just a product of one. We're just the newest experiment. And I see white altruism, it arises from this white settler colonial perspective of moral superiority. Because we have always, as white, morally superior people, created the rules and the values and the dogmas. This is what you shall and shall not do. And we've done that across the world. And we have a history of doing that. And I'm this little white girl that got born in America. And I was born to some addicts that had no right having children. They were very abusive. I was born into a society that was full of trauma and chaos and rape. And I was displaced as a 7-year-old child because of divorce and the world and economics and drugs. And I was displaced from very southern brown Texas as a 7-year-old little girl. I was very brown passing, long dark hair, dark skin. My kindergarten and first grade picture, I'm the only white kid in that picture. I am surrounded by color. So that was my kindergarten and first grade. At 7, I was displaced to rural Tennessee, right where I am right now. And it was the first time I'd ever heard racial slurs. It was the first time I'd ever heard that type of hatred. I was used to domestic violence now. I was used to some fists flying, some yelling, cussing, screaming, the drugs and the parties. I was used to that kind of violence. White trashy violence, I guess, in a way. Now I got exposed to this whole new type of violence with these words and these actions and these exclusions. You could see the very 2 and 3 bodies of color that we had in our second grade class were excluded. And I wasn't used to that. So I got displaced. So I woke up and I had a lot going on one day. And so I decided that I see it. I refuse to unsee it. So now I'm going to yell and scream about it because that's just who I am. I like to yell and scream about things sometimes. And so when we live in this society that I've witnessed firsthand, think and inflict that moral superiority upon other people, other religions, other bodies of color, just, I mean, women, these white male rich men. So I call it white altruism. I see us as a U.S. society from the very beginning to where we are now, just using these ideas of humanitarian aid, mission supports. You know, we like to come in and we like to help out. So I see a cycle, right, of settler colonization, white settler colonization. These Christian missionaries, usually Christian, they come in and they're gonna see how they can provide you with humanitarian aid. Then they give you this humanitarian aid. Well, then right here comes the military, because now we need to feel, we got to occupy this space. We need to protect this space. Now we're here providing you with some humanitarian aid, right? And here's the good Lord of the word. Here's the word now. Now we're going to bring in the military and we're going to create our own space because we deserve that space. Then there's the genocide and the erasure. And now we have our settler colony. And I see this cycle. And like I said, once you see it, you can't unsee it. So I see white altruism, and that's where my PhD is headed. I'm about to turn in that proposal. I'm doing it right now. Got to go through my oral defense. And what I want to do ultimately, though, is I want to go in locale. So I'm here as I was here as a little white girl in Tennessee. I grew up. I went off for education. I came back, and I've decided that all this education and all this experience that I have, I want to bring back to where I came from. And I want to give to this small, rural, white, Baptist, Christian town what I've learned. I want to give back. I want to invest. I want to grow it. I want to progress it a little bit. And the only way you can do that is showing up and reframing. So I'm here to reframe.
Boy, that's a Saybrook term if I ever heard one. There you go.
Well, it's very much a white racial frame, and I want to reframe that and turn it around and, and just give it a new twist, a new lens to look at it through.
It kind of goes to the point, I think, we've been talking about with our Justice, Equity, Diversity, and Inclusion Council around, the work that white folks have to do both personally, but also within our communities, and correct me if I'm wrong or if I'm way off base here, but it seems like that you're demonstrating through action that if you're going to see any sort of change, you have to work within your white rural Tennessee community to start to effectuate that change. Am I missing the boat here,
No, you're in the boat. We're paddling. Here we
we're
go.
paddling together?
Here
Okay,
we go.
yeah.
We're going down this stream. That's to me, that's exactly what we're trying. We're preaching, walk the walk. There, why should I go anywhere else and try to affect change or tell them, right? Us and them. What if I go over there and say, no, y'all, listen, y'all been messing up for a while. No, I can come right here. That bred me, that grew me, that reared me, this school, this town. Specifically, I'm in McKenzie right now. Now, they have a different school district than the one I went to. Now, I had some experiences in elementary and high school there, whew. But it's the same school, Carroll County district. So I'm in my local, rural,
I
small
know
Tennessee
right where
area.
that's
Yeah.
at. I've been there. Yes, yeah.
So I, that's where I am, and I have no doubt I'm headed towards the Board of Education soon. I'll be coming around, and I'm going to be jumping on the Board of Education. I will be jumping in the City Council. I will be getting out there as a mother of four children, as a higher educated, as an academic, as a researcher, soon teaching. I hope to someday be a college professor. Like I never thought I would say that, but I feel like that's where my world is headed. 'Cause what am I going to do with all this knowledge other than read, write, and then teach it? Spread the word. We got to spread the gospel now. So I'm all about it. But I hope that that's where I see it. That's where I see it going. I see myself someday going into public relations, going into public health, and definitely research. And so I came home to Carroll County to do that. I want to help progress this area and grow this area and heal this area. So I'll be part of it.
Very cool. Well, we're sadly at the end of our time together. I if we could have a little fire emoji on your screen. I mean, that's awesome. You are passionate. The fire in your belly is like so palpable. It's very, very inspiring. I appreciate that. I needed to hear that after a really weird week of politics, and you were inspiring to me. And I'm sure inspiring to our guests who will hear you in a few weeks here today. Before we end, I ask all of my guests two of the same questions. Now, the trick is these are quick takes. These aren't like long takes. These are quick takes. I know you can, you've been doing just fine. So this isn't a statement on you. So the first thing that comes to your mind with each of these questions, don't stress about it. But have fun with it, and you won't be graded, I promise. So this has no bearing on your future. You're going to actually knock it out of the park. So the first question is, what does the term humanistic mean to you?
Humanistic means to me love and hope and inclusion, and it means to me the ability to walk into a safe space, knowing it's a safe space, no matter where you walk into. To me, that's humanistic. It is just looking at the world in one way and seeing nothing but love and hope and inclusion and acceptance, because we're all humans on the same journey. We arrive the same way and we're leaving the same way. So,
You get the high five award. That was beautiful. Perfect. And the last question. So we're going to frame this a little differently because a lot of times we have psychologists or psychology alum or students on. For you, what are the top three things someone can do right now to make positive social change in their community?
right now, to make positive social change in your community, reach out to your local district. See who is running your districts. That's the first thing you can do. Go to congress.gov. Go Google online who runs your local house, who runs your local senate, who runs your local district. See who their names are. That's number one. Number two, to infect positive social change right now, start following everyone. Start following, and I don't mean select news media or select universities or select research. I mean follow everyone. We want to see every perspective. We want to see every thought. Because even when you read perspectives that you disagree with, you're triggering your own mind to say out loud why you disagree with that. Because you should know where you stand.
There you go.
Challenge yourself. So that's going to be my second one. My third one for positive social change immediately would be to just, goodness gracious, go to your local library and hang out. I think that that should just be spread amongst the world. Go to your local library and hang out. Support them. Get to know them. Pick up a book. Watch, volunteer for a local children's program. Support financially a local children's program. We need access and open access to everything, to all literature, to all minds, to all stories, to all beliefs. And the one way to keep open access is to support your local libraries. So that's a huge ordeal for me. Support them.
So I am going to my library today.
Good.
And I'm going to add on a few more news outlets just because you inspired me.
Really should. Follow everybody.
There you go. Dr. Almost. Katrina Szczesny. What an inspiring interview. This is a Friday afternoon, and I have to tell you, I'm walking into the weekend. Not that that was your intention, but I'm walking 10 feet high in the clouds above. Really, really beautiful, beautiful interview today. Thank you so much for being here. Wow, wow, wow. Katrina, amazing, amazing interview. I hope you all enjoyed Katrina as much as I did. Remember her three major takeaways on advancing social change. Reach out to your local districts. Find out who runs them. Get to know your representatives. Number two, start following everyone, all the news outlets. Every perspective is essential, and challenge yourself around those perspectives. And number three, go to the library and hang out. Just hang out. Get involved where you can. If you want to see the YouTube version, please see our Saybrook YouTube page. And if you'd like to support the podcast, go to Apple iTunes and leave that 5-star rating and review and subscribe so you can get episodes as they come out. If you're on Spotify, leave that 5-star rating and review. Make sure to follow us there as well. And you can, of course, subscribe to us on most major podcast platforms, including Google, Stitcher, Pandora, and many others. Remember to check our show notes for information on today's guests, including links to websites, books, and the like. And for more about our university, go to www.saybrook.edu. Click on Areas of Study at the top of the page and locate the program of your choice to learn more. In Katrina's case, check out Transformative Social Change at the top of the page, or simply Google Saybrook University Transformative Social Change. That's all for today, folks. Thank you so much. Take care and be well.